Hello, I'm Maddie Lohman. I'm a master's student in the Statistics and Data Science program and a PhD student in the Ecology, Evolution, and Conservation program here at the University of Nevada, Reno in the College of Science.
Hi, and I'm Paul Hurtado. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Mathematics and Statistics in the College of Science. I'm also a faculty in the Ecology, Evolution, and Conservation Biology graduate program here at UNR. And we're your co-hosts for this episode of the Discover Science podcast.
We are living in uncertain times, having just reached the endemic stage of COVID-19, with wars breaking out and another tense election year in the United States. There are plenty of opportunities for misinformation or disinformation to arise.
Yeah, so today we're going to talk about some of that. And with us is Dr. Jevin West. He's an associate professor at the Information School at the University of Washington. He's also a visiting professor, associate professor at Berkeley. And he's joining us for this episode of the Discover Science podcast. So Jevin, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks for taking the time to have me on. This is a topic that I get the opportunity to think a lot about. So we'll have some fun today.
Yeah, cool. So I guess maybe before we start talking about science and misinformation and all those fun things, it'd be good if you could, we could learn more about you. So maybe tell us about your role as the director of the Center for an Informed Public, and how often are you working directly with the public in that role?
Absolutely. So my colleagues and I founded we co-founded this center back in 2019. This was minutes before the pandemic, it seemed. It was actually in December, but it seemed like minutes before things really went south when it comes to the pandemic. And it was at that time that we had been, for many years, worrying about this issue of misinformation and its and how it impacted things like elections and crisis events, and impacted even things like science, which I care very deeply about. And so we got together and we wrote we did a lot of work writing proposals and things to get it established. And now it's a center at the University of Washington that spans multiple departments. It's housed in my school, which is called the Information School, but is connected to the law school, the computer science department, the engineering school, the College of Arts and Sciences. And we have PhD students and postdocs from all these different disciplines working on this program. And in the first couple of years, I agreed to do the directorship, but now I've turned that over to my colleague, Kate Starbert, who's been doing a great job leading it. I'm as active as I was before, but a little few less meetings here and there, dealing with some of the challenges you can imagine when you're studying misinformation. So that's a little bit about the center, maybe we'll get more into it later.
Yeah. So you mentioned that it was right at the beginning of COVID. How did that shift kind of the launch of that?
Right. Boy, did it ever. The plan actually was to study the issue as it related to crisis events and elections and places where there's always a challenge when it comes to, you know, getting to the to sort of reliable information. But like for many researchers, it changed our trajectory pretty dramatically during that time. We'd always been collecting publicly available data on these issues, like on, you know, from Twitter or now it's X. And when we started, you know, working on COVID, that's if you look at what we were collecting, it was mostly what people were talking about at the time. And actually, if you look at academia, there's been some nice analyses on it. We've done a little bit of this ourselves, but looking at how others in other fields shifted from the work they were doing in statistics and even in biology, certainly, and physics, and all these different fields that were shifting to trying to pay attention to this problem. And certainly when it comes to misinformation, we were working on that pretty much 24 hours a day. We had students and faculty working on things like doing really deep qualitative work, trying to understand the online communities around discussions of vaccinations, to doing large quantitative computational social science-like studies, looking at the ways in which ideas were kind of swarming, like a swarming, school of fish or whatever. In fact, we hired a postdoc that had expertise in studying schooling behavior in fish and came and used the same kinds of models to study schooling behavior of ideas on Twitter, which was an interesting way to think about the problem. But yeah, so that, I mean, I would say that most of our work during COVID was on COVID because that was what was in front of us, but also because that was what people were talking about online.
Yeah, cool.
I guess these large events can often mask kind of smaller things happening in the background, if that makes sense. Things fly under the radar, like other sources of disinformation, maybe not about COVID, but about other topics in politics and health, et cetera, et cetera. Did you guys look at any of that, what disinformation outside of COVID was being spread kind of under this radar of all this kind of, you know, very warranted worry and media attention towards the pandemic?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And we did do that. In fact, some of the most effective kinds of disinformation campaigns are ones that do fly under the radar, not just under our radar as researchers, but radars of those on trust and safety teams at these different social media companies, and under the radar of rules that, you know, at least the few rules we have on the internet. And some of the ways in which we looked for those hidden areas of the internet were to look at groups like diaspora groups. So we have a researcher in our group, Sarah Nguyen, and Rachel Moran, who's been working on looking at the ways in which these issues disproportionately affect those in diaspora groups. So they were looking at a Vietnamese diaspora group in Seattle and how they were being impacted by information very differently than we are in the English-speaking world. The information they were getting were coming, of course, from the United States, but also from Vietnam and other sources that we don't necessarily track because we're looking at these larger trends that are going on. It's hard to ignore, you know, some of the hashtags that arise after a major new policy that's passed around masks or around vaccinations or a major new vaccine that was released or a new finding around the pandemic or, you know, around the virus itself. And so the challenge, of course, is figuring out where you go about looking at that. And so, you know, a lot of this is driven by the students saying, you know, I found something really interesting over here. We should be taking a look at that sort of thing. And I think where we did the most interesting things were when we crossed the language border or when we crossed topics. Like another thing during the pandemic, there are lots of things that continue to occur, like, you know, there's always been discussions around fluoridation, but that kind of went under the radar. But it was still being talked about in some communities during that time, but it gets overshadowed by some of the larger stories that you're saying. And I'll give you one other example. So the when you think about, some of the big stories that occur that are driven by daily news, sometimes you forget some of the ways in which these things are connected, too. So they seem to converge. So a lot of individuals that you might find in one community, let's say a community that is convinced that 5G is causing health effects or 5G is, essentially activating something in the vaccines or, you know, there's infinite stories, I can tell you, that you see that these same individuals, sometimes organizations, are a part of many of these different groups that push and proliferate certain kinds of rumors. And so it's interesting, this idea of looking at some of these less focused areas. When you do that, you end up seeing how they kind of all are connected in some ways, too. I guess it kind of is that way online, but it really comes that way in studying rumors online.
So it sounds like you work with a pretty diverse group of people. Your background, your graduate training is in biology. What's it like sort of shifting out of that sort of narrow focus in graduate school, and then also now working with a pretty like multidisciplinary team of people, and like, you know, A, what's that like? What are the benefits of that? But then also B, what makes that work? Like, can you just get any old pile of people with different expertise and throw them in a room and great things happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think most of the time, yes. And I think the reason to do it, or there are kind of two reasons. One, it's fun. Yes. It's fun to learn about what my colleagues in psychology are thinking about and how that relates to things I'm concerned about. It's fun to talk to my computer science colleagues to learn about the newest algorithm and the ways in which it's being misused and abused. It's fun to learn from my biology colleagues to figure out about what are some of the big challenges, you know, with CRISPR technology or whatever. You know, there's, it's just fun. But at the same time, I think it's highly effective at addressing big challenges like misinformation or climate change or a pandemic. Like a pandemic, you're not going to address a pandemic just by hiring a bunch of really smart epidemiologists. That would help. They're smart and they know a lot more about it than I do. But goodness, we need policymakers and legal scholars. We need computer scientists that can figure out ways to capture data and better understand what's going on online. We need to hire sociologists that understand some of the social issues around this and political scientists. And it's not so many of the biggest problems we have in society today can't be addressed by single disciplines. And I might be biased because most of my career has been an active training in navigating and, and moving around, hopefully not aimlessly, but moving from one discipline to another. A lot of the work I did in biology was interdisciplinary. And then I spent time in a physics lab for a postdoc. And I work a lot with computer scientists and sociologists now and psychologists. And so maybe that's just the world I like to live in, and I think it's effective. So there might be a bias going on here, certainly a selection bias issue. But I also believe strongly that that's how we're going to solve some of these big problems.
So what you're describing is this incredibly multidisciplinary and integrative group of people working in this, information school. So with that, would you consider that kind of multidisciplinary integrative approach key to information science as opposed to something more narrow like engineering or statistics or economics or public policy? Is that the difference, or is that just one aspect of that difference, or am I just completely off base?
No, this is a good observation. In fact, I'll give you three different answers, maybe two. We'll start with two and then maybe I'll get to the third one. So one reason we might be so interdisciplinary is we are kind of a hodgepodge group of individuals that didn't see ourselves just in one discipline. I didn't quite fit in biology as an individual. It would have been probably hard to get a faculty position given all the computational work, but I wasn't quite in computer science. I wasn't publishing as much in ICML that my colleagues would have expected me to, but I was publishing a little bit in biology, and also I was publishing a little bit in economics. But the information school embraces that. So I think maybe we gather those kind of individuals. We're kind of a new thing on a lot of campuses, but it's called different things on different campuses. It's basically individuals that are interested in the ways that technology interfaces with society and humans' everyday lives. And so we study technology. And for me, I study the ways in which it impacts science, both in good ways and bad ways. But I also think that the problem at hand, which is large, it's this, what's the impact of technology on society? That's a big thing. And there's no way you could do that just in stats, or you couldn't just do it in a design school or a social science college. So maybe it's the question at hand, but there are skills that need to be picked up. And I'm not totally against, some of the disciplines that we have named buildings on campuses. Having that, there is value in that. There's a common language that can tie those disciplines together. I just think, when you see the emergence of centers, for example, on campus, they're typically problems that don't necessarily fit in one school. And so I think going forward, and universities have recognized this for a long time, that we need a mechanism for addressing challenges that would take too long in the old brick build. Like, it takes a long time to get a brick building in the name of your discipline, so that would take time. So I think an information school is just kind of a way, at least, to address the big challenges around technology.
So I guess with that, during your answer, you mentioned this idea of technology's impact on society, right? And I always wish I could remember who said it, but there's that quote, writing is going to be just devastate the youth's minds because they won't be able to remember
yes.
anything. So I guess just with that in mind, what do you see this role of technology and information, this constant stream of data, more than just, writing on a clay tablet? How do you see that impacting society? Is it positive, negative, or neutral? And especially with the proliferation of data, what do you think that larger impact is and might be moving forward? Sorry, that's a huge question.
No, it's a huge question. I hope we have 5 hours here tonight, because that is really is, and it's a question that I think a lot about, and clearly you're thinking about too by asking the question. I think it's all of the above. I think it's good in some ways. It gives us access to information to go about answering questions maybe faster than we could have in the past. It doesn't mean we couldn't have asked those questions, but we can do that more quickly. I can access a paper quickly. I can, you know, throw up an analysis quicker. I can do a presentation faster. There's things that we can do faster. But on the negative side is that we're overwhelmed with information. So overwhelmed that it's hard to identify the most reliable information out there. I only have so many cycles, and we all only have so many heartbeats during our lifetime to be able to read all this material. So when people get so excited about, you know, LLMs, wow, they're going to write our papers for us so that you can write 500 papers a year instead of five. Well, who's going to read those papers? The AI? Maybe, but then that, you know, I guess we're just turning AI over to science. I don't see science as something that's just done. It's a social process. It's that engagement that's as important as actually the product of science, which could be papers, some think, but it's also the ideas and knowledge. So I when I think of technology and its role in society, well, I mean, I spend most of my time on the critical side of it. I spend time thinking about the ways in which it's slowing the institution of science, the way it's affecting society in negative ways. But I also see its potential, certainly its ability to, find protein structures in ways that we couldn't have and would have taken too long. The its ability to mine genomic databases in ways that, you know, we could have never done, you know, at least in a lifetime. There's so many things that it can do that we couldn't do before. But what it also does is it creates, the challenge today is not the information, that's not the limiting resource, of course, and it's not evidence. That's not the limiting resource anymore. The limiting resource is our time to ascertain what's useful and not to read and to try to understand. And so it's, the overwhelmingness stuff, at least as it impacts science, is one of the big challenges going forward and being able to decipher what's useful and not.
Yes, I mean, so there, that sort of segues into some other things that I'd hoped we'd get into. And on one side of that, there's, you know, how does that impact science and how we do science? On the flip side, there's this question of how does the sort of general public, right, sort of digest what science and other sorts of information are throwing at them and make sense of all that? So I don't know. There's a lot of directions to go there. I don't know which way you want to take it.
Oh my goodness. Let me just start with one, Paul. These are all great questions and really episode length kinds of answers needed to give them justice. But let me just start by saying that the public's engagement with science is a very good thing. I want that. I mean, it's the rise of citizen science, for example, gets me so excited and puts a smile on my face. This is what we want. Science is not something that can only be done by those in the ivory tower. We should all be engaging in science. So when I talk about the ways in which the public, for example, engages in ways that are, that there may be misleading information out there, or they may not have the same training that we get the opportunity to have working on a campus, working in science every single day, that they might not be able to tell the difference between a predatory journal and a journal that's more reliable. Not perfect, but more reliable. They might not be able to tell that just credentials, PhD credentials, don't guarantee that someone is, you know, more reliable than the other person that they heard in the lecture halls at a public lecture. They might not understand what a random control trial is. The public wants to engage, but they might not understand the ways in which science tries to formalize uncertainty, and that these kinds of things. There's all sorts of things. I could go on and on and on. And that's our job in science. That's our job in education to provide that information. But without those tools, things can go awry sometimes. And people can be misled. And by the way, people might have ideas that are different than even the consensus in science. That's even okay sometimes, but we need to do a better job talking to the public about not just evidence that they have to support some story or narrative that they have, which is great that they can have that, but to come to the table with a discussion about how they decided what was a reliable source, to tell me what your methods are for prioritizing one source over another, essentially having discussions about epistemology. How do they know what they know? We need to have more discussions about that. And then we can have discussions about the evidence that they have at hand. And I think we can have more productive conversations when it deals with science issues. But I just want to really emphasize that I am such an advocate of engaging the public with science. And when I saw that during the pandemic, you know, and having the public see science happen in real time and how messy it can be and how people change their opinions, thank goodness they change their opinions when there's new evidence. It doesn't mean they're the equivocating and that they don't they're not sure. It's just sometimes new evidence come and you change your opinion. That's science, wonderfully, but it's also messy. Anyway, just trying to teach the public about the social elements of science, that it is a social process. It's not something that facts just drop down from the sky.
So something I wonder about with that, you talk about epistemology and engaging the public. And obviously, K through 12 education and outreach opportunities are critical, vital, super important. But something I always wonder about is how do we bring this quantitative literacy and this science literacy to adults who have a lot less free time, who are dealing with a million life things, but that is valuable information that, you know, they just might not have been exposed to at that point in their lives. How do we reach out to adults specifically who are trying to engage with data, with information, with science, but might not have the resources to do so right away, at least?
You are talking about a topic that I think is so important, and it truly is the long-term strategy that we need to improve in this area, because so much of the world is being quantified, and for many reasons, that's a good thing. It's part of what we do in science. But we don't do a very good job, and I admit that fully, in educating the public, even educating people within the professional world of science. Sometimes we need to do a better job of this. It's challenging, though. So I think we need to think about informal settings for teaching this. So one of the things that we're doing in the center is we have a National Science Foundation project that engages rural libraries, that engages community organizations, community colleges, just because of the great access to the population that community colleges have, and then K-12 schools. We also have been working and partnering with AARP and organizations that reach some of the older adults in our population. I think we have to figure out ways to reward that work too, because on a campus, you know, we're kind of rewarded. Okay, did you get your, let me see your CV. How many publications do you have? Well, it would be great to be, those are good publications, but you know, what kind of public impact do you have? We're at a public university. We're funded by those taxpayers, and it's our job to give them the tool set so they can make good decisions. Because I think most people, I would say all people, but I would say most people by a pretty large margin genuinely want to get to the right information, that want the tools to be able to make good decisions for themselves, for their families, and for their friends and their neighbors. And there is a lot of information out there. It's even hard for those that are professionally trained in these areas. But because the world is so quantified, we need to figure out ways to teach them data reasoning. It's something that it's a passion project for me, and I've written about this with my colleague. I have a class on this, but there's all sorts of great efforts around the country where this is happening as well. But it's only, you know, it's a drop in the bucket. We have to change the way that we do education at all levels. And I think it's in these informal settings that work. And I'll give you one example that I absolutely love. At least when it comes to media literacy, quantitative reasoning is another issue. But we have this program it's called Misinfo Day. The idea is that we bring high schoolers to campus and we spend a whole day thinking about media literacy, which includes data reasoning. But that's one day. And that might be the only day sometimes these students will get to talk about media literacy in the context of these different subjects. But then what spurred from that event was, and it was started by a high school teacher and a high school librarian, where they teach high schoolers that for an entire semester, and then they teach their grandparents, their neighbors, and their parents about this. And I love it because those are people, the kids that the grandparents are actually going to trust. They're not going to trust me, like a professor, or maybe they will. I'd like that. But they will listen to their grandkids. And I think that's a chance to do some intergenerational learning. So I think there's opportunities like that. But we need to utilize the infrastructure we have built in our country around this, which are libraries and some of these community centers and other things to provide these opportunities. Because, boy, the information world and the technology world is changing so fast that if we want to prepare our public to be most successful and not fall behind, that we need to figure this out soon. And the quantitative reasoning is a big part of that.
Yes, I mean, I think you hit upon this issue of trust as being an important part of how information gets conveyed. I was wondering if you could sort of maybe define misinformation and disinformation and the differences between those two things. And then, what is your advice to people on either, on the one side of being a sort of science person, right, developing that trust when you go out and do sort of public outreach type things, but then also for just being your, general citizen, right, as a consumer of knowledge, how do you learn who to trust and who not to trust?
Yeah, trust is such a big part of this issue, not just for misinformation, but for the institution of science. I think the public puts a lot of trust in that institution. And fortunately, it's one of the most trusted institutions. There's been a little bit of drop over the last several years during the pandemic in different parts of the population. But overall, still, when you compare it to other institutions, it's trusted to a high degree, which is fortunate, but that's not a given. And I think we have to work at that to continue to maintain that trust. But for me, when I talk to the public, just going out in person, I find is the best way. I think online is probably one of the worst ways to go about doing this. And that takes time and it doesn't scale well, but it truly is the only way, I think, is to talk to people and to listen as much as we speak. And I think those are basic tenets that we could we've been taught since we were young, but they're really important for this particular issue in gaining that trust. But it also needs to come within the communities themselves, and I think because people trust those communities, so we have to let that be driven. And so we call this, when we do this work, it's co-participation, it's co-design. We have a project called co-design, and we co-design. This is not something that we come in and sort of land some papers on the desk and say, this is what you need to know. No, we talk to them about what issues they care about most in this space. And as they interface with science, there are some issues that some communities care about more, whether you're in an agricultural company or a community, or whether you're in a community, in downtown Seattle. I mean, there's going to be different issues at hand, and then that's where we start the conversations. But I think, these issues of trust, too, are really, when you talk about all institutions, are a real serious issue right now. In a democracy, we depend on this trust. So when people continue to see, technology get better and better at creating deepfakes and images and videos and audio and text that's not generated by humans, my fear is that makes us even less trustful of the system. And that's what concerns me most. And so when that continues, that is concerning, because people retreat into their small communities, and we depend on people's expertise in different areas. There's just too much to know about the world, and so that's an issue that we have to address, and it has to be done. I really think offline is even more so than online. And so yeah, I think this issue of trust is such a big one, but it's a tricky one. And so What are we going to do in the next pandemic, or what are we going to do in the next crisis where we need the public to respond as a collective and not in ways that are so distrustful? And so, yeah, we have some serious challenges ahead, because trust in these institutions took a big hit.
How do we find that balance then between this trust and then media literacy, which requires skepticism and critically engaging questioning? That's a hard balance to strike. So I guess, how do we educate the public, whether in person or online, about how to walk that fine line?
We spend a lot of time talking to the public about being skeptical, but we don't want to push that too far where they then have no trust in anything. if you become so skeptical and like, I don't trust anything. In fact, I've talked to middle school students about this, and I see this more from the younger folks than any of the other groups that I talk to, that I'll show them something and they'll go, well, yeah, I mean, I don't trust anything on the internet. And I'm like, whoa. I'm like, so if you go to this Wikipedia page and I'll show them something about some math concept or something, like, no, I don't trust it, because that's been edited by lots of people. But I'm like, but actually, here's some reasons why it might be one of the beacons of light on the internet. Let's like, it's okay. I mean, not perfect, and there's problems. So I think what we have to do is remind them of that there are places that are more reliable. They're not perfect, but just little tips like, you know, does the news venue that you go to, hopefully you go to some, do they admit mistakes? Do they provide links and references? Do they do some self-reflection when they make a mistake? Do they have retractions? Are they right at least most of the time? You can't expect perfection. You know, if something sounds too good to be true, yeah, probably is. Or if it sounds too good or bad to be true, you can trust your gut sometime. I mean, not fully trust your gut, but if you do that, you need to pause a little bit and do a little bit of extra checking. I think that's helpful. And then if you see something that, you know, is kind of worth sharing, before sharing it, maybe do just a little extra work before. I always sort of say, you know, think more, share less. We should be thinking a little bit more than we do and sharing a little bit less and feeding these algorithms for, you know, sharing to the next person and amplifying sometimes things that aren't worth amplifying. So, yeah, like walking this really thin line of trying to figure out how to help people become skeptical but not too skeptical, I think really comes from case studies and examples and practice. We have to practice it all the time. I have to practice it all the time, and I teach it. So I think it comes from practice. I think that might be one way of at least addressing it and then reminding ourselves not to be too skeptical.
So so I'm a bit of a crazy bird watcher when I have the time. And one of the things that was sort of a big I don't know if you would call it like a scandal, right? But there was this big to-do about a few years ago. Someone reported they had observed an ivory-billed woodpecker, which of course is extinct. And there was actually quite a bit of conservation money thrown at trying to protect the habitat and go in and see if they could actually get some more concrete evidence that at least one or more birds existed there. And the result of that was no concrete evidence. And so it generated a lot of questions about, you know, should all those resources have been spent that way or not? And it got me thinking about, well, you know, there's sort of varying levels of, I guess, sort of misunderstanding, misinformation that float around sometimes. And some of these are more consequential than others, right? So a very inconsequential example of, I guess, a bird-related thing would be sometimes people think they find this new way of, you know, looking at some field mark on a bird that, you know, there's two species of birds that are really similar, and when you have them in your hands, you can measure things and tell them apart pretty easily. But when they're, you know, 50 yards away and you're looking at them through binoculars, they're really difficult to tell apart. And so somebody will think, oh, I found this new, you know, ratio of these two spots on these feathers that now I can tell them apart. And it turns out that you know, if you do the statistics, it's not a great way of distinguishing the two species, but it'll catch on. And there's sure some minor consequences of that negatively impacting citizen science projects and things like that. But so have you given much thought to the sort of consequences of different kinds of misinformation and how that feeds into doing outreach to teach people ways of identifying misinformation? Because it seems like people can get very dug into a certain idea. And when you approach them about, hey, I think that you might be listening to the wrong source of information on this, they're really defensive about it. And that puts up a lot of obstacles to trying to have a meeting of minds, right? So have you looked at the sort of ways in which you can approach these topics with the public and how the nature of the specific topic factors into the success of that outreach, or
Absolutely. And I love that example. And I feel, or I found, I feel and found, that practicing on the inconsequential, or at least less consequential, prepares us for the consequential. And that's why I love that particular example. In fact, you may know about iNaturalist if you're a bird watcher and someone appreciates being a naturalist, you know, every day.
That's where all my non-bird observations
go. Yeah, your non-bird, exactly. And so you know that. Actually,
the bird ones go to eBird.
So, right, exactly. Well, what's interesting is, so I'm doing this visiting professorship at Berkeley right now at the Information School where iNaturalist started. Yep. And I've got a chance. Actually, I knew I was playing around with it myself because I'm also a fan of these things. And I loved the way that discussions were happening around these issues. They were sort of, I call them sort of nano discussions or nano arguments. And so you would, you know, you would adhere to the evidence and people from all across the political spectrum could come to this site on this issue and practice what we try to practice in science. And it doesn't work perfectly every time, but it works pretty darn well. In fact, I was so excited about it at one point. I started talking about it and I ended up talking to a New York Times author about this, and she ended up writing this beautiful story about iNaturalist and how it could potentially be a model for some of our other social media endeavors. Because it what it did is it provided that substrate to practice the kind of norms and behaviors around disagreement, which is okay. It's again, disagreement is not a bad thing. That's a good, we want to have healthy environments where disagreement occurs, but we need a process by which we adjudicate those kinds of things. And so, so I loved the iNaturalist. I love this example. And the thing that got me thinking, and that's your question, that I've been thinking is maybe we should be doing more practice in these inconsequential, less consequential, I should say inconsequential. They're consequential too, yes, to some degree, especially for all the naturalists out there. but we need to do this in ways that, or we need to do it in these environments so that we can be more prepared in the ones that are more consequential. And of course, there's other elements when it comes to more politically charged issues, but I think it's good practice, and it might be a model because there's a system that's been set up at iNaturalist and other places, and you know this better than I do, that have that are quite effective, and I just think that we have a lot to learn by looking at those systems, and I just love the ability to take sort of these again like these very very discretized pieces of evidence. Here's my image. Do you see this? Do I see this? Not sure if I see, you know, and we can do that actually on social media. And we do see it to some degree, you know, with groups that, for example, are, you know, monitoring satellite imagery and they'll have discussions about this. And those have sometimes very consequential issues if it deals with conflict or it certainly deal with the pandemic and things. And so I do kind of see it playing out in other environments, but I just, yeah, by the way, I love iNaturalist and, yeah, you'll have to take me birding sometime.
yes, can do. One thing that I have noticed is that sometimes people are really good at communicating science to scientists, right? And they're not so good at communicating that science to the public. And then also vice versa. There are some people that are just wonderful at engaging with the public about these things. Do you think people should be great at both, or do you think it's fine if people are good at just one or the other?
Well, I think the most important thing is that we're encouraged to engage if we're willing to. Not everyone is willing to or wants to or is good at it, but I think at least trying, because that human aspect is an important part of science and it's an important part of communication and it's an important part of trust, and we need all of those things to continue this great thing that we get to do in society. I mean, I see science as one of the greatest human invention that's helped us solve some of the biggest problems. And also, by the way, it's super fun and there's so much to be gained from the activity. And the more that we can engage the public and not isolate the public, that's why in a further question, we were talking about, you know, some of the issues that can occur if someone doesn't have quite the training and they can be misled. And that does happen. But goodness, let's engage in all forms that we can. And if you're good at one thing, and if you're a good communicator, we need that. In fact, we have such a small number of science journalists in the United States that are the full-time scientists. In fact, there's been some studies on this that, you know, we depend on people's goodwill and their free time and their willingness to sort of, you know, do the sort of Uber, you know, selling of their time as a journalist. So, you know, moving from one journalist venue to another just to make ends meet. So we depend on that sort of effort and by scientists taking their free time that they're not getting most of the time rewarded on campus for doing. And so I just think that we really do need to engage and provide the mechanisms for doing that. And then we do need to reward it at some degree for faculty that are really doing that sort of thing, because it takes time away from some of the other traditional things that we need to be doing, but maybe there's a balance because we need it more. I think we need it more than ever.
Yeah, definitely.
So something I think a lot about is K through 12 education, especially as someone who really struggled with quantitative literacy growing up and I didn't have a class in media literacy. Like, that is a lot to teach a kid. So something I wonder about is, how would you start to introduce to our youth these concepts of media literacy, quantitative literacy, these kind of social dynamics governing how we receive information, and knowing whether to trust it or be more skeptical? When, I guess, in a child's education would you think is a good time to introduce that? How do you think we should go about introducing that in the most effective way possible to create adults that have this ability to critically engage with information and walk that line of trust versus skepticism?
It's a great question. And I think we should start K-1. And I think we can do that partly because I've seen it happen in other countries. So I've been spending time with colleagues in Finland. And Finland always is high on the education markers. They're embarrassed of their position. They're very humble people. And they're like, well, those things are not so – they're critical of their own ranking being at number one. But they integrate media literacy and I would say quantitative reasoning to a pretty large degree across all disciplines, everything they do, especially media literacy from K-1 through, you know, let's say in K-99, really, because they have great informal programs for their adults as well. And so I think it can happen. We're starting to see some movement within states. So the state of California and other states and our state, and I'm sure Nevada will be up there as well, are considering new curriculum standards around media literacy. Because at this point, a lot of teachers just have to find ways to insert it in their already busy schedules. And our teachers are already spread so thin that asking them to create new curriculum, to integrate it into things, into curriculum that's already packed is a very challenging thing. So I think it kind of has to come a little bit from the top, at least. It certainly can happen bottom up and top down. Bottom up meaning the teachers can figure out, are very creative individuals and will figure out ways to do this. They understand the need. It's not like they're naive to this. They understand how important this is. But it will help to have some of this legislation passed in different states to require it. And actually, we're seeing it across the political spectrum. Like, states like Texas have passed some, and states like state of California. So it is happening. We're tracking that sort of thing. And we're a part of a lot of program development. And all the stuff that we create is freely available. So any teacher out there that's listening or librarian or anyone wants to use it, everything we create is free, and we've been creating it for years. And that's created based on topics that are of that time. I think we need to at some point figure out how to create some national standards, because it's so important to everything everyone in the U.S. does every day, you know, that we engage with these information environments. And so it needs to engage not as a 30-minute class that you take once in high school. It has to be integrated across all things, and certainly that should also include quantitative reasoning. And that's partly because that's in everything we do as well. And so we're just catching up with things. And so education moves slowly, and that can be a good thing, to some degree. But for this, because it's just so integral to everything we do, we should probably be looking to models that are more similar to, like, Finland.
Cool. So you mentioned that all this is freely available. Is this on the Center for Information?
Yeah.
For an informed public
yes.
website?
Yes. So okay, the URL is cip.uw.edu. ucf.edu. We have resources. Those are all freely available. We also point to other people's resources, and we're continually updating things. You can also just email me or the center. The center is better because we have a great person that's managing a lot of those emails. If you have questions, we can send you information. And like, if you wanted to run like a Miss Info Day, for example, either in a high school or a university, we have some grant funding to help you do that. So it won't last forever. So if you're interested, we really want to help. But this is just kind of like a Band-Aid right now. I think ultimately it has to be integrated across our education system. This is the long play. Now, there's things that we can do policy-wise when it comes to reducing the spread of misinformation. But policy, it's super slow. We could think of, you know, we could look to our technology leaders and say, help us. But they've made a lot of mistakes too. And I don't have a lot of faith in that as the perfect solution. But the thing I have more faith in and more optimism is just using old-fashioned education to better arm the information consumer, all of us as information consumers. I would love to hear your thoughts as educators and students in the quantitative world, what we need to do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I would agree that there is no being too young to learn sort of critical thinking skills. I think there's just age-appropriate ways of doing that for all grade levels. I think one of the big things I see from the mathematics and statistics perspective is that we sort of tend to isolate that separate from everything else. And I think there's a lot of room to integrate quantitative skills, mathematics, statistics, you know, programming and working with computers can also sort of fall into that category across basically every topic. You know, I mean, if you're a journalist, you need to know some stats and how to make graphs and how to communicate that stuff, right? And so I think there's just a lot of room to integrate things more than we do.
Absolutely. Yeah. And then I look to you, Maddie, who is integrating sort of another discipline like ecology and evolution and biology more general with some of your quantitative training. How do you see, you know, this, you know, how could we use your experience to build a better sort of way of addressing this for the public?
Yeah, absolutely. I think about that a lot, actually. I got into statistics because I liked wildlife biology first, and I was introduced to statistics in this more abstract way, not this concrete, can you figure out the algebra and calculus kind of way, but more let's think about how these systems work. How can we understand them and translate them into these statistical models? How does math work to understand our natural world? And for me, I think that's a huge thing, is some people are awesome at arithmetic and algebra and calculus, which is sick. Not everyone has that natural talent, including myself. And for me, when I think about how can we, I guess, expand education to just have this stronger kind of quantitative literacy element for everybody, is, like Paul said, incorporating these other disciplines and looking at mathematics and statistics in this more abstract way than just numbers and decimals, I guess, and making it very clear the very direct application of all of it.
What I loved most about, there was so much you said that was great, and what you said too, Paul, it was just fantastic, but it was that you don't have to be the most talented to be able to still work with these tools, these quantitative tools, and can help you then get to what you're really interested, whether it's in biology or chemistry or business. And I think that that's something that we should encourage people. And one of the things that I wanted to do, at least with some of my class that my colleague and I, Carl Bergstrom, talk a lot about, is empowering people with these skills, that data reasoning shouldn't be something that intimidates you, but can empower you. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I remember talking to you, Paul, before we even started this podcast, is the different ways to go about teaching statistics and sort of swinging back and forth based on the topic. I think that's that. I don't even know if we have time to even you mention. I just thought it was such a clear way of thinking about, you know, how we go about educating the public about this.
Yeah, I mean, I think just to summarize that conversation really briefly, a lot of mathematics is taught sort of from first principles, and then you logically derive everything. But another way about doing it is to sort of start with the big concepts, and maybe it's okay if they're sort of defined in a weird, amorphous, not quite clear way, but you sort of then build down into the details and refine those formalisms. And I think, you know, just being an educator who works with students in mathematics as well as students in, you know, the sciences that maybe they're coming from a place that they don't just have a really strong math background, I see both of those folks kind of meet in the middle just the same. I see the math students really struggle to wrap their head around the science, and they figure it out. And I see the science students that forgot every math class they ever took. You know, they've got a lot of intuition and conceptual understanding that once you sort of connect up what this, you know, equation means in terms of that context, it clicks for them, and then they're up and running, and they're in good shape. So, yeah, so lots of ways of sort of lots of ways to skin a cat.
I just love that, and that's and I'm so glad that hopefully we conclude some of that, because I just hearing from your students and faculty about how they think about this, these issues around quantitative reasoning and how we integrate that to make us better consumers of information online, because that is, you know, one of our big challenges in society. And I think a big part of that is the reasoning part.
Well, thank you, Dr. West, for joining us today on the Discover Science podcast.
And thank you so much for having me. This was so much fun, and we could have talked for another 3 hours, but I think our listeners may have run out of gas in their car if they're listening to us or something.
Yes, and I'm sure they can read more. You've shared some great resources with us. So, yeah, thank you, and it was a pleasure talking with you and learning more about your work. So,
well, thank you, and it's been a pleasure thinking and learning from you as well.